Okay. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
My name is Esther Men, and I'll be speaking with you this session on understanding Jewish and Israeli perspectives on the land. This is a part of a series called Perspectives on the Land, and so far we've looked at the theme from Deuteronomy 8 on 40 years in the wilderness and the gift of the good land. And we've looked at American perspectives on the land, focusing on Lakota perspectives. Today we're turning to the Middle East and looking at the situation in Israel-Palestine, which is such a, I don't even know if I have any words for it. Such a calamity, such a heart-wrenching situation. It's so difficult to get a clear sense of what's right and wrong over there because each party has such a long history and such commitments. So what I'd really like for us to do is try to understand some of the dynamics involving the land over there, and particularly today to focus our attention on Jewish and Israeli perspectives on the land. And then on Friday, we'll have another session that will focus on understanding Palestinian perspectives on the land. So the way I planned this short hour that we have together is that I'm going to take you through as quickly as I can through the history of Israelites, Jews, Israelis in the land and their connection to the land. And after I do that, then I'm going to lift up several diverse voices with differing perspectives on what's happening currently within the Jewish community, both in Israel and here in the United States. Then I've asked Rabbi Marks to come to be present at this session, and I have requested that he makes a few comments after I'm done, perhaps giving his perspective on something I've said or on another topic. And then I'll invite you all to share your views and reactions. Now, if there's anything that is unclear as I'm going along, or if you do have a comment, please feel free to interrupt me. But there is a lot of material, so I won't be stopping formally for comments. So please just raise your hand if you have anything that you'd like to raise. Already in our study of Deuteronomy 8, we saw that the theme of the land and the land itself is important. It's central already from the biblical times. And the Israelites loved and lived in a land, and not just a land in general, but a specific land, the land that was promised to Abraham and the land that was entered after the Exodus and the 40 years in the wilderness. That first time we explored how it probably was rather complex, the entrance of the land, although Joshua depicts it as a violent conquest. There were probably waves of peaceful infiltration as well, intermarriage, joining together various groups. But both the stories involving Abraham's travels from Ur to the land that God will show him and the story of the entrance of the land by Joshua and the Israelites, both these stories acknowledge that the Israelites that, and later their descendants, the Jewish people, were not indigenous peoples to this land, but were latecomers. But it has become a mightily important part of the identity of the people. And I was going to read to you, but I do not have the resources of the fireside room or Fire Creek room. I was going to read to you again Psalm 122 that we heard last night. I was glad when they said unto me, let us go to the house of the Lord, about pilgrimage to Jerusalem and how it's such a center of the memories of the people and their traditions. And yet there's a living connection of the people to that place that the current generation goes and then comes back and wishes peace for Jerusalem. So I felt that that psalm that we read at last night's Vespers really illustrated the continuing connection of the people with the land and particularly with Jerusalem. So the land of Israel has always had a central place in the imagination of the Jewish people. It's the geography of the Bible that's read. It's the direction, Jerusalem is the direction towards which Jews face as they pray. The phrase, next year in Jerusalem, is repeated at Passover. And the whole idea of the ingathering into Jerusalem has had messianic overtones throughout the years. There's always been some Jewish community in the land, and certainly beginning with the end of the 19th century, there's been more and more of a movement of Jews back to the land. Now, when I was in Jerusalem from 1998 to 1999, I lived in West Jerusalem for about 9 months, and that's the Jewish section of town. And I experienced among my neighbors a really profound sense of connection with the land and a joy in the land, a feeling that this was really home. And you could sense it in so many ways, a kind of concrete way was if you remember Deuteronomy 8, 7 to 8, it talks about the good land of streams, of springs and underground waters flowing out of the valley and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vine and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive trees and honey. All those fruits, wheat, barley, vine, fig trees, pomegranates, olive trees, honey, those are all there. And so there's just this connection between the people and their scriptures and their life in the land, and celebrating the cycle of years there and so forth. It was just truly profound. But for most of the history of the Jewish people, they've lived outside of the land. Ever since the Babylonian exile in 587. In 587, okay, I can stop talking into the mic. Okay. Oh, so there's no miking at all. Okay, how many people didn't hear anything that I said? How many people have heard? Okay, good. Now I'll start talking a little louder. Okay, thank you. Okay, so, and especially since the Romans put down two Jewish revolts in 70 and 135, Jewish settlement has been mostly outside of the land, but always looking back and traveling back. But there's always been some Jewish community within the land of Israel, or Palestine, as it's variously been called, under different governments. So what we have that's new is in the emergence of Zionism, named after Zion, the Temple Mound. And so Theodor Herzl, who was from Budapest, he was reacting to the growing anti-Jewish sentiments in Europe. And he strongly felt that Israel needed to be a state, that the Jewish people needed their own nation with their own language and their own land, like other peoples. And he envisioned a secular state, actually. And the British offered land in East Africa. But eventually that didn't turn out, because there was not the same connection. But that was actually offered. What we had, though, in this time was now a return of Jews, especially from Russia, where there had been pogroms and killings of Jews, a lot of anti-Semitism rising at that time, back to the land of Palestine, which was under the Ottoman Empire at that time, so Turkish rule. And they started farming collectives. The motto was, a land without a people, for a people without a land. And the land was relatively sparsely settled, and so it looked like an opportunity to go in to buy land, to have collectives and so forth. So there was a return to the land at that time, which was quite new in its size. Now, after World War I, yes?
Was there any particular area of Israel that they settled?
There were settled, the earliest kibbutzim were in the north, in the Galilee region. That was one area that was settled early.
Tel Aviv.
Tel Aviv, yes, Tel Aviv. That is actually the name of one of Herzl's books called Old New Land. Tel is the site of an ancient city, and Aviv is spring. So it combines the imagery of the old and the new. So Tel Aviv, definitely. What about Jerusalem?
Jews were always in Jerusalem. It was the holy city.
So the Jews that were living in the land throughout history were attracted to Jerusalem because they tended to be religious.
In the 1865 edition of Britannica, the encyclopedia, they gave populations, and they were about equal, Arabs, Jews, and Christians, with Jews having more, a little more, than either of those two in Jerusalem, not the rest of the land, but in Jerusalem.
In 1865.
Early Encyclopedia Britannica.
Very interesting. They have a wonderful chart just outside of Jerusalem, where you can see the city there. Now I can't remember the name of the quarter. It's an artist's quarter, and there's a windmill there. And they have a chart that gives populations and breaks it down like that and shows that it was equally divided, and then the Jewish population increased.
Ma'alot
Shananai. Ma'alot Shananaim. So if you go there, go in and look at that. Thank you. So once World War II was over and the Allies had won, the Ottoman Empire came to an end because the Turks, Turkey had aligned itself with Germany. And so the British were given this region as a mandate. Oh, yes, definitely. I have that. I'm sorry. I misspoke. After World War I. Thank you. World War I. Now, as early as 1917, the British had been negotiating with various Arab and Zionist leaders and had made kind of contradictory promises. And in 1917, there was the Balfour Declaration. Expressed British support for a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine without violating the rights of non-Jews. And Zionists interpreted this as support for Jewish immigration and the emergence of a Jewish state. But the British also had concern for the future of the majority population, which was Arab at this time. Now, in the 1930s, There were riots by Arabs as Jewish refugees were coming from Germany. It was a very tumultuous period. And the British proposed dividing the territory into two separate states, but this was rejected by the Arabs because they were by far in the majority at this point. And so then the British suggested limiting Jewish immigration, and the Jewish inhabitants rejected that. But there was a limit set on Jewish immigration, even through World War II, as the 6 million Jews of the Holocaust were killed. Well, by 1947, the British realized they weren't going to solve this problem, and so they left, and they asked the United Nations to solve the problem. And so that's what we have. On November 29th, 1947, we have the partition proposed by the United Nations, number 181, to divide the territory into two, one for Jewish and one for Arab states. I'm not sure even if the word state, I hear states referred to in discussion of this, but I haven't looked at the declaration itself. But, and with Jerusalem under international control, and the Jews accept this, the Arabs reject it. Now, what we should remember is that in the early 1900s, there were only 10% of the population was Jewish. So 90% were Arab. And the partition of the land that the UN recommended was 55% of the land would go to Jews, and 45% of the land would go to Arabs. So there were about 600,000 Jews and 1.5 million Arabs. Yes? It's a very good question. And I don't think it was that clear. So what you had happen then is that you have the declaration of independence by Israel as a state, and the British withdraw, don't deal with the whole issue of who's going to live where and so forth, and you have the invasion of Arab nations surrounding the neighbors to help the Palestinian Arabs to keep the land and so forth. And the result was that Israel gained additional land. Some estimates about 23% of the land. Jordan claimed the West Bank, and Egypt claimed the Gaza Strip. So you had an additional 700,000 Arabs flee from the new areas that were occupied, and so we have refugees created. So you do have Arabs living within the borders, and then they remain, and they're still there as well. But a number fled, and so we have the problem that's persisted with the refugee camps. So there have been further wars, 1956. For our purpose, since we're concentrating on the land, the most important one is that where the West Bank was used by Arab forces to attack the State of Israel. And so there was a response, and the rest of the land was taken. So the West Bank and Gaza were taken by Israel, as well as Sinai and the Golan Heights of Syria. So Sinai had been occupied by Egypt, and Syria had the Golan Heights. Now, that included, the West Bank included Eastern Jerusalem, which then in 1980 was annexed to Israel. And Sinai since has been returned to Egypt under the 1981 Camp David Accords. And before all the current conflict, while I was there actually in 1998 to 99, there was a negotiation about the Golan. It was quite a hot topic, but it looked like Israel was moving towards giving back the Golan. So in the wake of the takeover of these lands in 1967, the United Nations issued another resolution, and that's that 242 that you always hear about, which stated that, which asserted the inadmissibility of acquisition of territory by war. So it instructed Israel to retreat to its defensible borders. So it's called for withdrawal, but it didn't, it's interesting, this is used by Sharon, this term defensible borders, saying that the 67 borders were not defensible because they were used as a launching pad for other nations. So it's used by both sides. 242 is interpreted sometimes to mean withdrawal to the 67 borders, or by Sharon and those in his camp, to defensible borders. So there have been further wars, 1973 with the Yom Kippur War and the 1982 Lebanese War, and Israel's now withdrawn from Lebanon as well. But during this time, during the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, most significant thing for us here is that we have the growth of settlements in the West Bank. And this took off in a big way when Menachem Begin was the leader, and he was from the Likud, the conservative Likud party, from 1977 to 1983. But the biggest increase was in the 1990s, so just very recently. And that was when Ariel Sharon was the housing minister under Yitzhak Shamir, who was also Likud. So there was a program of offering incentives to move, not only to the borders anymore, but really to the heart of the West Bank and to Gaza. There was low mortgages, low taxes, roads built so that the commute to Jerusalem and other places would be easy. Security was offered, and utilities supplied, and water, which is really a controversial issue, was given in much greater proportion to the settlers. And so there's the scandal of swimming pools in some of the Gaza Strip settlements, whereas there's just not very much water in the land there. So this has been known in some places as suburban colonization, where you could live out there and still drive in. Israel's not a very big country. And many religious groups, such as Gush Emunim, settled in these areas because they believed that Greater Israel was given to the Jewish people. So now we have about 200,000 settlers in the West Bank, and there's about 6,000 in Gaza, and there's 200,000 as well in East Jerusalem, which has been annexed already. So usually that doesn't, the 200,000 that are in East Jerusalem usually aren't considered in the counts. So this is a doubling, about 200,000 or 400,000, depending on how you're going to count it. It's doubled since 1993, since the Oslo Accords. And that's shocking. When I was over there, you could see it happening. Big areas of land being bulldozed and prepared, even as there was supposed to be a freeze in the settlements. Now, under Sharon, these settlements are, in theory, restricted to only natural expansion of existing settlements. So, growth. Due to larger families or people joining. But Peace Now, the Israeli peace group, says that there have been 34 new settlements under Sharon. And I remember when I was there in 1998-99, on the news, it was reported that he was saying things which were very inflammatory, such as, you know, seize every hill and so forth. So you did have the feeling that there was a kind of a movement to take advantageous sites at that time. Now, the peace groups in Israel, so Israeli peace groups themselves, recognize that this is against Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, because we have illegal transfer of population into occupied territory. So the things that had happened in the 80s, 1987, we have the first Palestinian Intifada or uprising in response to a lot of these things that we've seen. And there's a kind of a movement, as in 1988, Yasser Arafat, who's been living in exile, condemns terror and recognizes the state of Israel. That was such a moment. That was, seemed to be a really different point here, because up to that point, the PLO and Arafat had not recognized the right of Israel to exist. So in this time then, in the 90s, even as the settlements are going on and so forth, there's a very positive kind of momentum and a number of peace initiatives. So in 1991, you had the Madrid Peace Conference after the Gulf War. And at the same time, beginning quietly, covertly, in 1993, you have and a declaration of principles that both Arafat and Rabin could agree to. So you had this interim Palestinian self-government where the Palestinian Authority would rule certain areas, and then there would be other areas that would be jointly administered, and then other areas under Israeli control. And the Palestinians agreed to accept a fraction of the pre-1948 Palestine as their land for a state. But there were remaining issues such as Jerusalem, the right of return for the Palestinian refugees, those that were driven out and their descendants, the settlements, and the borders. So those are really big issues. In 1994, Arafat returns. Things are still looking hopeful. And you have in 95, you have Oslo II. In 98, you have Y River. In 99, you have Y River II. So things are going along. And the most hopeful is the 200 meeting with Arafat, with Clinton, Barack, and Arafat, where it looks like Barack really did attempt to make some major concessions, and it looked very pliable. But the time frame, I think the time frame was just too short, and Arafat didn't accept at that time and didn't counter in a constructive manner, and he became blamed for the failure, even though I think he also was making some concessions. And we can perhaps explore some of this more on Friday. But he was already losing a lot of support from the people because of the concessions that he had made, especially about the right of return and so forth. So just as this is happening, we have Taba meeting after that, and it looked like things were even getting closer and so forth. And then there was just a change of government in the U.S., change of government in Israel to a very rightist leader. So I think it was just very unfortunate that all of this happened at the same time, because as we know, in September 28th, yes, Ariel Sharon takes his tour of Haram al-Sharif, the site of the mosque, the Dome of the Rock, and Al-Aqsa Mosque, the holy site of Islam, and the former site of the temple as well. And you have the start of the Second Intifada, which is encountered with violence from the Israeli side, and which fuels then what's gone on till today. So we have Ariel Sharon, who was the defense minister during the Lebanese War, and during this war that began in 1982, he was overseeing the refugee camps, and there was this massacre by Lebanese militia members at Sabra and Shatila. So he was removed and was charged with war crimes and so forth. So he once again appears, and everything blows up. And I think it's fueled by the anger at the Israeli violence and the compromises of Arafat and just sort of the whole stalemate. Oh yeah, Ariel Sharon is so in your face, in that since 1987 he had been living in the Muslim quarter in East Jerusalem in the Old City. With an Israeli flag draped and so forth. He's just very provocative. So he takes office in 2001 with 60% of the vote, and he's opposed to the whole idea of land for peace, and he targets the infrastructure of the Palestinian Authority. He has assassinations of Palestinian leadership, including Hamas leaders and so forth, and has eroded during his tenure the borders that are separating the Palestinian Authority-ruled areas such as Jericho and so forth, and the areas of Israeli control. And we've had mass arrests and so forth during his period. The situation has gotten much worse since 9/11 because the rhetoric of anti-terrorism that our government is using is being picked up and applied to Arafat, who's identified as a terrorist, and the Palestinian Authority, recognized as a terrorist organization. And so military action, which has included incursion with tanks and bombing of Palestinian Authority police stations with F-16s and Apache helicopters, and keeping Arafat penned up in Ramallah and even under siege, has all been labeled as anti-terrorism. I have a couple of examples of this. One is June 9th, 2002, so recently. This is Ariel Sharon. It's an editorial in the New York Times, where he's justifying the recent invasion beginning in March into the Palestinian areas. Okay, he says, the Palestinian leadership decided to initiate the current war against Israel after the failure of the Camp David summit in July 2000. Rather than resolve Israeli-Palestinian differences peacefully, it deliberately promoted a wave of terrorist attacks against the people of Israel. It failed to implement its written obligations to dismantle international terrorist groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad. Instead, it provided them with sanctuary in the area under its jurisdiction. That's exactly the same language we used for Afghanistan and the Taliban. It has also unleashed some of its most loyal forces, like the Tanzim militia of the Fatah movement and the Presidential Guard, Force 17, against Israeli civilians. Finally, Yasser Arafat's personal financial advisor, Fouad Shibaki, not only paid for many of these attacks, but also organized a consortium of Middle Eastern terrorism built on the Palestinian Authority, Iraq, and Iran. Those are two of those axes of evil. So you can see in his statement that he's drawing on the language of you raise up one of the complexities. Exactly. Yeah, there is no easy solution at all. So you can see, I mean, what people are being blown up. That's right. On both sides. Yes. Here's another statement by the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, here in this country. Israel must defend against this terror just as surely as the U.S. must fight and destroy al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups within global reach. So I'm not saying that the violence is not there, but what I'm saying is that the rhetoric is being picked up intentionally to justify really the largest military action since the invasion of Lebanon in 1982. And that was in March of this year, after a number of suicide bombings, the Passover bombing, and so forth. So tanks rolled into Ramallah and surrounded the presidential compound and into all of the Palestinian-controlled areas, Bethlehem, Jenin, Tulkarm, Qalqilya, Nablus, and so forth. And you had 24-hour curfews, house-to-house searches, mass arrests. no journalists. The Red Cross has called this a humanitarian crisis. There were reports of ambulances not being able to get through, which the Israelis say, well, we've seen ambulances that were carrying explosives. So once again, very difficult situation. So there was a withdrawal then. This was such a disheartening thing for me because these Palestinian-controlled areas, it really showed how vulnerable they are, that they can be entered at any time, that they really aren't as autonomous as they might look on the map or that they might promise to be. So in March, when tanks rolled in and took them all over and the kind of destruction that you saw in Jenin, it, my heart just fell. Yeah, thank you. So since the withdrawal, there's been more discussion, and Bush has been coming out now in support of a Palestinian state. Recently now, with the continued suicide bombings. And I came here on the 22nd, so the latest newspaper I've seen is the 22nd or 23rd, but with this bus bombing in Jerusalem and another bombing after that. Except for Jericho. Okay, Jericho had more autonomy. Okay, thank you. Yes. Lockdown curfew, okay. So, yes, as I was driving through the country, I was picking up newspapers and reading about the reoccupation of Ramallah, of Jenin, and so forth, with a new stipulation that they won't be returned until the terrorist attacks, until the bombings stop. And there's also been a recent move to surrounding the Palestinian areas with barbed wire and with trenches, and the creation of 8 zones that are separated with buffer areas and even a wall. So, yes, with all these borders and so forth and needing of passes. And even if you don't have the right kind of pass, you cannot go into Israel at all anymore. Yes, Lauren.
Could you give me an overall perspective? Are you feeling, appearing sort of a balance of what I appreciate? Are you trying to bring to a Jewish perspective or a Palestinian perspective today?
Right now, oh yes. How can your heart not go out to them? What I'm going to do now is turn to some statements and perspectives of Israelis that we don't usually hear. In other words, those that are seeking for peace and for those kinds of personal contacts that are going to really make the difference. I was trying to lay the groundwork here. Yeah, I can focus a little bit more about on Arafat, perhaps on Friday, if you don't mind, because I'd like to just move through some of these different statements and have an opportunity for more of our discussion. I'll just skip this one. because now we know that all the areas are occupied. But now, even within Sharon's own government, there's dissenters. So that Israeli Defense Minister Benjamin Ben Eliezer came out strongly against his government's new policy, stated Wednesday, of retaking West Bank areas slice by slice until terror attacks stop. I am completely against all permanent seizure of territories. I didn't agree in any form to punitive occupation, he told Israel Radio. So this is within Sharon's own government. He's a Labor Party member. And Ben Eliezer's Labor Party colleague, Foreign Minister Shimon Peres, agreed. We are against reoccupying territory, he told Israel's TV Channel 10. We are against the dissolution of the Palestinian Authority. We are in favor of preventative actions where they are possible. In contrast, some of Sharon's party faithful have been pressing for harsher measures, including reoccupation of all the West Bank and the expulsion of Arafat. So what's happening right now is not the consensus, even within the government there. And we mostly just hear what's happening, but we don't hear some of the other voices, dissenting voices. And I think also there's a kind of a closing in when there's a crisis, similar to when we were bombing Afghanistan, which I think some of us may have been questioning, but the whole status of being at war sort of prevents speaking out, I think. But anyway, I want to read a couple of statements by some Israelis here. This is by Jeff Halper of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. And he calls for reorganization of all the parties that are calling for peace, both Israeli, Palestinian, and international, to get together and to move forward beyond what's happening here. This is in March of 2002, so not in response immediately to what's happening. But during the 7 years of Oslo, Israel pursued a particular vision of peace, a non-viable and only semi-independent Palestinian mini-state that would relieve Israel of the 3 million Palestinians residing in the occupied territories, but would leave it in control. Israel's ferocious response to the Intifada came from a fear that the Palestinian street would break the PA out of the Oslo framework and lead it to a true dismantling of the occupation, to a viable and truly sovereign Palestinian state. This is the battle being waged now between an Israeli-controlled Palestinian Bantustan and a viable sovereign Palestinian state. Couching Palestinian resistance as mere terrorism and thereby cynically exploiting the simplistic anti-terror approach of the post-September 11th Bush administration, Israel is using its entire military arsenal, except its nuclear weapons, to suppress the Palestinian aspirations for once and for all. Sharon, who believes that there can be only one victor, has declared that the current offensive, escalated daily, will not cease until the Palestinians surrender. And then he goes on to call for all concerned parties, not only Israelis for peace, but also Palestinian organizations and international non-governmental organizations, faith-based organizations and political groups, to articulate their concern, to demand an end to the occupation, to coordinate, to give information and so forth. So an inspiring leader there. There have also been officers within the Israeli army that have refused to serve in the territories. So Asaf Oron is one who signed Courage to Refuse, a combatant's letter. And there have been hundreds that have signed this statement. We, reserve combat officers and soldiers of the Israel Defense Forces, who were raised upon the principles of Zionism, sacrifice, and giving to the people of Israel and to the state of Israel, who have always served in the front lines, and who were the first to carry out any mission, light or heavy, in order to protect the State of Israel and strengthen it. We, combat officers and soldiers who have served the State of Israel for long weeks every year, in spite of dear cost to our personal lives, and it goes on defining themselves, it says that we declare that we shall not continue to fight this war of the settlements. We shall not continue to fight beyond the 1967 borders in order to dominate, expel, starve, and humiliate an entire people. We therefore declare that we shall continue serving in the Israel Defense Forces in any mission that serves Israel's defense. The missions of occupation and oppression do not serve this purpose, and we shall take no part in them. And then there's the signatures there. Oh, I'm sorry.
I will. Ask a question?
Yeah.
I'm not clear about the conversation that took place at the end of Clinton's terms between Israel and the Palestinians, and what was offered, and what was not enough, why it was rejected, why it all fell apart. Would you find some time to explain?
Would you be able to come back on Friday? Because on Friday we can look more closely at that, and I can even draw a map and so forth, and we can look into that. I want to make sure that that Rabbi Marks has some time to talk. I'll just mention a few other things that I wanted to bring to your attention. One is a more personal response by an Israeli, Dalia Landau, who came to Israel at the age of 11 months from Bulgaria with her family in 1948. And her family settled in Ramle, which is one of the towns that had been seized in the 1948 war, and the inhabitants had fled. And her family lived in a house, an Arab house. And it was the only home she knew, and she came to really love this house in Ramle, and it had a beautiful lemon tree in the middle of it. Well, she later learned that it was not as she had been told, that it was not that the Palestinians living there were cowards or had been told to run by other Arab governments or anything like that, but it was a war zone and they had left and even had been forced out by Israeli forces. When she learned this, this started to change her view. And then shortly after the Six-Day War, she saw three Arab men standing in front of the house, and one of them, Bashir al-Khairi, said he had been born in the house and had been forced to leave at age 6. And so they came back to look at their house. And this really, really brought it home to her. She invited them to come in. She visited them in Ramallah and was impressed with the hospitality. And then the father of the family, Bashir's father, came to Ramle to see the house that he had built in 1930s. And he went out to the yard and he saw this lemon tree. And he started crying there. And so Dalia gave him lemons that he took back. And Bashir told her that when he would start crying and he would pace back and forth holding one of those lemons for solace. Well, to make a long story short, she eventually turned this house into something called Open House, which is a center now for the kinds of positive interactions for youth and other kinds of programs. It has a center for the development of the Arab child, and it has a center for Jewish Arab existence. So this is a very inspiring and positive personal story here. And I think I'm going to stop. There's so many wonderful things to tell you about. If you get the Lutheran magazine, the July edition has Rabbi Michael Lerner, who's the editor of the magazine Tikkun, and a rabbi who condemns the Palestinian suicide bombings but loves Israel, and tells Lutherans and other Christians, you need to be critical of Israel, because I'm critical of Israel even though I love it, and you cannot feel guilty about the history of the Holocaust. You have to give us tough love and be honest with us, because that's true love. Right. Yes, and how to move from now until then. Yeah, that's very inspiring to hear about that too. Now, Rabbi Marks, may I turn to you and ask you to make some, come up here, please, and make some comments.
It's not easy. I want to congratulate you, Esther, for a wonderful presentation. You talked about Israel from an unbiased point of view, giving the Palestinian point of view of Israelis. And by that, I'm saying something critical. You didn't talk, I think you mentioned suicide bombing in two brief sentences. Israelis are upset and reacting to the terror. The everyday people who live in Israel, who did not steal somebody else's orchard, are living in terror. In terror. And there's terror on both sides. I want to give you my credentials because I'd love to hear from you. I'm in favor of peace, and I feel it will only come when both sides learn to give up something. They both have to learn to give up something that they believe is precious. One is the dream that they'll hold all the land, and the other is the dream that they won't recognize the right of a historic people to return to its historic home. When you talk about the orchards, you have to talk about the Jews who were driven from Hebron years ago and were massacred. There are massacres on both sides. It is terrible. I have said there has to be peace, and I visited Israel 13 times. I met with Hafez al-Assad when he was president of Syria. So far as I know, I was the only rabbi ever to meet with him. I've met with King Hussein and President Mubarak and with the leaders of Israel in an effort to make peace. I believe it's possible. I believe it's possible. But both sides are gonna have to give up something. They've gotta give up terror. They've gotta give up hurting one another. And there are many of us who out of love are critical of what Israel is doing, out of love. That's important to say. Mr. Sharon is not my idea of a man who should be leader of a people of God, and I've said this. I've said it often. I have hosted those people who are members of Courage to Refuse, soldiers who refuse to fight a war of the territories. And they have said they're not gonna fight a war that will protect the territories. And they made a wonderful case. They said, because we're doing that, we're not protecting Israel. In other words, we're protecting these settlements that are out there, but we're not protecting Israel itself. And I agree with them. So that my point of view is that I believe that both parties have to start listening to one another, and doing something that will create peace. To stand at the Temple Mount, as the Israelis call it, at Aqsa, as Sharon did with 200 armed men, is not a peace gesture. It's not a peace gesture. There are some of us who are concerned that the settlement policy is not an accidental one, that it is not just bringing homeless people to settlements, but may be part of a policy of this government that says that the orthodox, traditional, radical point of view that all of the land sworn to Abraham belongs to Israel, that point of view might be one that is the dream of Israel. That would be upsetting. So, and there are Jews who feel that way. There are Jews who feel that every bit of the biblical land has to be returned to Israel. As I said this morning, the Bible makes good geography, but bad history. But bad politics. Good geography, bad politics, and that's what's happening. So my point is that there are all sorts of points of view all over the map. There are many of us who are just aching, just suffering that this is going on, who are who are friendly with Palestinians who want peace. I have visited Gaza. I have friends who live there. I have seen what happens. I have seen callous soldiers who are indifferent to the suffering of other people. And yet I have seen peaceable Israelis who have seen their children blown to bits, and they can't tolerate that. So, is there something we can do? Well, I would raise a voice of moderation. I mean, it's not going to help to say either side is bad. That's not good, because they're not bad people, for the most part. There are some bad people, though. I mean, there's some people who are totally uncompromising. One of the things is that Israel is the largest recipient of our military aid, and I'm not saying of our aid, but 3/4 of that is military aid, and you ought to understand that, which means we will lend money Israel if they buy our United States arms. So why do you think that isn't cut off? Because our own arms industry is a heavy beneficiary of this sort of aid. Now, that should come to an end. To say we ought to cut off all aid to Israel, some of it is humanitarian. There are people who need help there, and Jews have suffered. And I think as Christians, you appreciate that. Jews, over the past centuries, have suffered a great deal of persecution and need a place. I mean, one of the reasons that the Holocaust occurred was that there was no country that would take Jews. And Jews know that lesson very well. I mean, they tried to come here. You can see the stories of the St. Louis stranded off the coast of Miami. It couldn't dock with hundreds of refugees. And they went back to Hamburg, Germany, and they died in concentration camps. So Jews desperately need a place, but they don't need everything. And the Palestinians don't need everything. And both can compromise. That's one thing. But we ought to, you see, if you just criticize Israel, that's going to harden both sides. And if you criticize the Palestinian, that's going to harden both sides. What we have to do is be these voices of reason that are so desperately needed that say, cut out the military stuff, continue the humanitarian aid, bring the parties together, let them understand that they have to make some sort of an agreement where they can give up enough so that they can live together peacefully. I know we have just a couple more minutes, but I saw, yes, Barb.
What's your perspective on Michael Lerner's movement and that involved?
I love what he says. Michael tends to get involved in himself an awful lot. But we all do. I mean, I suppose Michael would say that about me too. In other words, it becomes his drive for peace. And the truth of the matter is that there are thousands and thousands of us who are Jews who are very sympathetic to Palestinians, but who come to that sympathy out of a love for the people of Israel. And Michael is doing some good things. I think he's doing important things, and I support what he's doing too. And I'm doing it through the Courage to Refuse movement, which is to support an indigenous movement in Israel. I was on the board of Peace Now, which was an Israel-inspired movement. In other words, I feel that you have to listen to the people who live there and who want peace at the same time, and that's what I tend to do. Yes,
you're right. Who do you think the moderate leadership is in Israel right now?
Well, right now, the radical leadership has taken over. I have
the wings to do it in a different way.
There are people. There are people who live on the kibbutz in which I've stayed for time after time up in the Jezreel Valley, who have spent their days cooperatively helping one another. It's sort of like a Holden village on a permanent, maybe enlarged basis. That's what Kibbutz Ein HaShofet is. There are some people there who would refuse to fight the war of the territories, that are leaders of a movement called Mapam. There is this Israel defense minister who, surprisingly enough, has turned against his government. And there are people, but what has happened, unfortunately, is that the suicide bombing has sort of galvanized Israel public opinion. It's done the opposite of what it should do. Instead of creating a peace movement, it has said, well, we're also threatened that we have to support this man who is really has a terrible, terrible record. And that's what's happening. Do we have time for one more? Is there? I think it's, yes.
Is it correct that the amount of military aid is approximately $3 billion per year?
The amount of total aid is $3 billion a year. The amount of military aid is $1.8 billion. Now, those figures are not up to date. Those were a couple years ago. But I don't think they've substantially changed. Imagine that $1.8 billion is really not aid to Israel. It's aid to our arms industry in support of that. So I think that's one thing we ought to deal with. Thank you, Esther, for inviting me.